We're talking about bad habits and how to break them here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. No doubt our environment influences behavior. And during COVID, that home office has presented stress eating challenges. My weakness is the pantry. I don't know about you, but Kitchen Island is where I set up shop. I munch on a box of salty crackers, and just like that, they're gone. Or those fresh cookies my daughter pulls out of the oven. I have to have one, maybe two. Okay, three. Are you feeling more stressed, and how do you handle it? Has that led to bad habits that you want to bring under control? Who do you turn to when it gets hard? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Judson Brewer is Director of Research and Innovation at the Mindfulness Center at Brown University. As a psychiatrist, he helps patients understand how their brains work to achieve deep, permanent change in their lives. Dr. Brewer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how are you holding up these days? How are you coping?
I can't complain. My clinic has gone completely virtual, and that has worked surprisingly well. My wife and I live near some woods, so we get to get outside, as much as we can. We're very fortunate to be able to do that. And we'll see how the fall semester goes as everything ramps back up.
What is it like to see patients in a virtual setting? Do you feel like you can connect with them?
Not as well, but certainly, better than both of us being concerned about is spreading or catching contagion. So, video conferencing. I've actually been teaching various classes online through Zoom for years, and so I feel pretty comfortable with that setting. And as long as my patients can manage the technology, doing video conferencing, it gives us about 90% there as compared to being in person. So it's really much better than I thought it would be.
Okay, so my initial assessment is that you haven't taken up any bad habits in the pandemic. If I turn the tables on a therapist here. Do you feel, though, that it is more difficult in these times not to maybe have a bad habit here that you turn to?
Oh, definitely. I think here, and I'll speak for myself, but I've also seen this in the research that's coming out, when we're right near all of our vices, whether it's the kitchen, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. or the pantry, or, the liquor cabinet, we're near these things. So there's proximity. And also there's, there aren't office workers where, they're looking at us like, is he going to the break room again? So I think those things in combination with a lot of uncertainty really bring forward anything that might have been, little problematic where it can just, go wild now.
What is on that spectrum of things we call bad habits? Can you put some quantifiers around it?
Yes, it's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. So I want to be super clear. Habits generally are helpful. Imagine if we woke up every morning and we had to relearn everything from how to walk, to put on our clothes, to make coffee, to cooking breakfast. We'd be exhausted by noon. So there's a spectrum, I think, of as, learning habits that are helpful. And then as you go along that spectrum, these habits can become unhelpful. And this definition of addiction that I learned in my residency training is continued use despite adverse consequences. So you can actually think of that as the far end of the habit spectrum. Good habits on one end, continued use despite adverse consequences on another end. And so, somewhere in the middle is probably where most of us live. But I think a lot of us are creeping toward that continued use despite adverse consequences. And the reason I like that definition is because it applies not just to the classic addictions like drinking and, opioids and smoking and all this stuff, but this could be cell phone use. This could be social media. This could be checking our news feed where there's continued use despite adverse consequences.
We are learning about bad habits and how they form, what to do about them with Dr. Judd Brewer. He's an author and psychiatrist. You can join in with your questions. Have your bad habits gotten worse during the pandemic? Maybe you smoke cigarettes or use drugs, bite your nails. Are you stressed more during these times? Has that led you to developing bad habits that you want to stop? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Brewer, how long does it take for something to edge to that area where now it is having, you know, a bad impact on your life, so much so that it is considered maybe a habit, and then that next layer, an addiction?
Yes. Well, it really depends on the person and the behavior. So I've had patients, I had a young patient, a young adult who somebody had given her some heroin at a party and she was immediately hooked after that first time. So there's the extreme end where, you know, something can literally blow your mind so much that you're addicted. And then there are the other ones that creep up on us. You know, maybe we check the news and, you know, or we check our social media, you know, once or twice a day. And then, you know, we wake up a year later and we're, you know, we're like, how did I spend all this time on, you know, I'm spending 4 hours a day on social media. I actually have some of my college students in one of my courses, I have them track their social media use. And some of them, you know, they sheepishly come in and say, yeah, I was on social media 5 hours today. It's like, how do you get into your studying done?
So it's like a second job.
Yeah, exactly.
But so you really have to pay attention. And, you know, paying attention is something that you have researched and really looked closely at. How do we go inward and really understand what's going on in our body?
Yeah, you know, I was really surprised by how little research has been done on paying attention itself and how it relates to addictions. You know, in my residency training, I'd learned, you know, a lot of these willpower type things. You know, if you're trying to quit smoking, set a quit date for 2 weeks out, and then, you know, we'll give you some medications that with withdrawal, and then basically good luck. Or, you know, if you want to lose weight, just make sure you have more calories out than in. Well, it all makes sense on paper, but in pragmatically, that's not really how life works. So I started looking into this to see, you know, what were we missing? And it actually turns out that there's a lot known about how these habits form. And I think that's the first step toward kind of understanding what's going on and breaking habits, is just understanding the process. So that's the first thing I actually teach my patients. That's the first thing that we give people in our training programs. We've developed these app-based mindfulness training programs for habit change. And the idea is, if you can't understand how your mind works, how can you possibly work with it? So the first step is just helping people map out these habit loops. You know, what's the trigger? What's the behavior? And what's the result of that behavior? And from an evolutionary standpoint, this is actually how we learn to survive. You know, so you see food, you eat that food, and then your stomach sends this dopamine signal to your brain that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. So that's an evolutionary, very adaptive survival mechanism. Yet when, you know, everybody has a refrigerator, at least in developed countries, you know, we don't need to remember where food is, but that mechanism is still at play. So step one is bringing awareness and just being able to map out these habit loops. I'll give you an example with anxiety, because we've seen this shoot up in the last couple of months as well. You know, I had a patient who came into my office he was referred for anxiety, and I, you know, wasn't sure exactly what was happening. And he described to me how he had severe panic attacks because he was worried that he would get in an accident on the highway. And so we mapped out these habit loops. So he would be on the highway, and then this trigger would be a thought, oh no, I might get in an accident. The behavior would be that he would get off the highway, and then the result would be that, you know, he would avoid that bad feeling. But that led to him avoiding driving on highways at all.
We are talking about how bad habits form, how to change our ways. Brown University psychiatrist Judd Brewer is our guide. You can join in. Have you noticed family or friends developing worrisome habits during the pandemic? How are you helping them? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, we're talking about identifying and accepting that bad habits exist and how to take action. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The devastating spread of COVID-19 has put a spotlight on our nation's mental health and the growing stress level of Americans. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, is collecting household survey data on symptoms of anxiety and depression. Since April, women consistently report higher rates than men. The pandemic has negatively affected psychological well-being. So is your work situation, being laid off, furloughed, or working in an essential job, is that contributing to the formation of bad habits in other parts of your life? How are you managing the stress? Has your ability to cope changed recently for better or worse? What happened? It's 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Judd Brewer, Research Director at Brown University's Mindfulness Center, and he stays with us. Dr. Brewer, you were talking there about that habit loop and that where the brain just turns on in a particular way with this anxiety situation that you laid out for us. So how do you undo that loop? How do you stop it?
Well, this also comes back to understanding how our minds work. So our minds, when given a choice between two things, they're always going to choose what I think of as the BBO, the bigger, better offer. So for example, broccoli versus chocolate, right? That's kind of a no-brainer for our brain. That's why we don't feed our kids broccoli and chocolate at dinner at the same time, because we can guess what's going to happen. So that very basic mechanism can also be, we can kind of leverage that to help people break bad habits. And the first step is to help them understand and see very clearly in their own direct experience how unhelpful the old habit is. So that reward value of the old habit goes down. For example, we just finished a research study where we can actually embed what we call a craving tool for where we have people pay attention as they eat, whether it's junk food or overeat. And as they pay attention when they do that, that awareness helps them see, oh, wait a minute, this isn't quite as rewarding as I thought. You know, that second cookie isn't as great as the first, and that third cookie, and now the fourth, and I'm feeling guilty in my stomach. You know, I have this gut bomb and all this stuff. When they see all that, you know, the emotional response, when they see that they don't actually feel that good, that reward value drops. And we find that within 10 to 15 times of people really paying attention as they do this unhelpful behavior, that reward value drops significantly. So that opens the door or opens the space to bring in that bigger, better offer. So whether, let's say that it's overeating, what we find is that people actually realize that not overeating feels better than overeating. And so we give them, you know, this little challenge, like how little is enough, and have people pay attention. It's like, okay, this next bite. Okay, this next bite. And where is it that that pleasure plateaus and then starts to go down the other side where it's actually less pleasurable? And at that point, they can stop eating and realize that they feel better right then as compared to overeating, for example. And in that way, they can actually reduce their calorie intake in a way that's not forced, which is very different than the traditional, you know, just stop.
Yeah,
type
right.
of thing. Does that make sense?
It does. But in this bigger, better offer, I'm wondering, is there a way to make the offer even better and stop at that right time when the brain says, oh, wow, we could go for a walk, or we could, have a cup of coffee? Or I'm trying to think of how to make it a better offer.
Absolutely. So that's just one example of how, you know, just kind of stepping out of the old habit feels better than being stuck in it. Mm-hmm. And like you're pointing out, there are other things that actually feel even better. So for example, let's go with eating and then we can talk about anxiety. For me, I started exploring the difference between eating gummy worms and eating blueberries. And, you know, when I really started paying attention, because I used to eat gummy worms by the entire bag. You know, you couldn't have one in the kitchen because I would just have to eat the whole thing. But I found out that, you know, these, when I really paid attention, I realized they actually taste like petroleum. You know, they're really not that tasty. And they just get me jonesing for more. Whereas blueberries, oh, just really, especially fresh ones like right now, fresh blueberries taste great. And there's they fill me up to the point where it doesn't feel like I have to eat more even when I'm full. So they're even comparing things that are sweet but healthy, like blueberries, to things that are very like overly sweet and not healthy, like gummy worms, really helps our brain see really clearly how, you know, one is better than the other. And I think it's really hard to beat nature in terms of stuff that really tastes delicious. You know, I've never heard somebody say, you know, that fake, you know, Doritos type thing was so much better than that home cooked meal.
But we have to give nature a chance in order to have those aha moments.
Absolutely. And that's where awareness comes in.
We're talking with psychiatrist Jed Brewer, directs research and innovation at the Mindfulness Center at Brown University. We're learning how bad habits form and how to help get them under control. Let's take a call now. Dave is joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not addicted to like cocaine or you know, booze or anything, but I am. My wife and I were both raised on farms, and we had grandmas and moms that made really yummy stuff, you know, like cinnamon rolls, pies, whatever. That was our sort of our treat after working hard on a farm. But I'm 64 now, and my wife and I have been married 40 years. But since the COVID thing, we haven't been going out to eat. But my wife dug out these old grandma cookbooks. And being a truck driver, I have to keep my weight down to get a med card, you know, keep everything down healthy. And I was doing such a good job here. But since the COVID thing, my wife, and she retired like a year or so ago, but she's been baking like homemade strawberry rhubarb pies. She's been making things, and I mean, I was raised on that stuff, and I really have to watch it. And I did lose 20 pounds, but I mean, it's starting to come back again. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, God, I got to quit eating this, you know. And then I get home, and my wife says, "Oh, look at this wonderful cake I made." I'm like, "I can't eat that, please."
And there's a sentimental value in that, I would assume, Dr. Brewer, as well. I mean, having those remembrances of childhood in that food.
Yes. So I can totally relate to this. So I grew up in Indiana. My uncle and my grandparents were farmers, and my grandparents actually made strawberry rhubarb pie that was to die for. So here, it's not that we absolutely can't have these things. This is where, you know, it's like understanding where we can bring in healthy foods, not forcing ourselves to do this, but really bringing these in most of the time and seeing how delicious that type of thing is. And then occasionally, you know, enjoying the strawberry rhubarb pie or whatever. And I'm not in your wife's shoes, but I'm guessing, you know, it feels great to cook something that smells good and tastes good and all of that. But we can really start to notice the difference, you know, like even when eating that, you can play with, okay, how little is enough? You know, can I just have a very small piece of this pie? And maybe the pie will last the entire week as compared to 2 days or something like that. So even there, bringing awareness in can help cut down on that. And at the same time, you both can play with bringing in, you know, what's it like to eat some fresh berries, for example, for dessert or something like that. Does that make sense?
Does that make sense, Dave? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we discussed this, and I'm starting to peel the weight off again. But I told her, I said, you know, this is really loving of you to make this for me, but we've got to cut back, and that's kind of what we've done. So,
I wonder, Dave, too, if you could share stories between each other about, you know, growing up and you know, those recipes that were in your youth, and maybe as you're eating it, you're also remembering, you know, what it was that brought your family together.
Well, we do that, you know. We sit around. My wife will make something like that, and we'll go, "Oh my God, my grandma's made this. It was so good." And my wife makes it pretty much identical, if I can remember my taste buds, you know. But we definitely cut back. But I mean, that's a total weakness for some people. The sweets and the we don't buy anything like at stores, but my wife will make something, and you know, just but we do it now. because I have a med card coming up. We do it now like once every month or once every few weeks.
Well, Dave, thank you. Yeah, thank you for bringing that and sharing that situation. And Dr. Brewer, what could you tell for people out there who have had a significant shift during COVID and are looking for those comfort foods?
Yes. Well, here, this goes back to really seeing these patterns and seeing how they creep up on us. Because, you know, might say, oh, you know, I haven't made a pie in a while. And then suddenly, you know, we're doing it three times a week because we're at home. So just recognizing that that habit pattern creep is the first step. And then also just comparing that, you know, what's it feel like after we eat a bunch of sugary food? And how's that compared to eating, you know, unprocessed, you know, non-high carbohydrate, non-high sugar things. That's the place that will help us start to shift back to places where we were pre-COVID. You know, before, what do they call it? The quarantine 15 is where a lot of people, you know, are settling out, so to speak.
Brown University psychiatrist Jed Brewer is with us as we discuss how to deal with bad habits and what they say about the times we're living in. Are you a former smoker or a tobacco user? How did you quit? Do you think addiction is about willpower? Do you believe that some people have more of an addictive personality than others? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up, maybe hear from you right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the emergence of bad habits amid the COVID crisis and how we handle these challenges. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The pandemic and its economic fallout are taking a toll on the mental health of many Americans. It could be more acute for young adults. Roughly 2 in 5 college students reported symptoms of depression. In a survey of students from the end of March through May by the Healthy Minds Network, which is a research project based at the University of Michigan, are you experiencing symptoms of anxiety? Do you meditate regularly? How has that helped you be more present with your feelings? Are there some bad habits you could easily give up, but others you can't seem to shake? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Psychiatrist Judson Brewer is at the Mindfulness Center at Brown University, and he's our guide. Dr. Brewer, what role does willpower play in bad habits and addictions?
Do you want the truth or something that sounds good?
Bring it on.
Okay. So there's been a heuristic for the, you know, last half century at least around, you know, using willpower to change behavior. You know, I think a lot of it emerged with the development of cognitive behavioral therapy, which, you know, the one liner on that is basically catch it, check it, change it, you know, catch a cognition, check to see if it's distorted or true or whatever, and then change it to a different cognition. So that, and that, neuroscientifically, that's been shown to involve, you know, cognitive control networks in the brain. Unfortunately, there isn't a lot of cognitive neuroscience that specifically backs up willpower. The more, you know, there's this famous marshmallow experiment in the 70s done by Walter Mischel at Columbia, which turns out people were not able to replicate it. And, you know, a lot of that turned out to be basically privilege. You know, a lot of Columbia professor kids were in the study. And then, you know, that was the factor that drove success as compared to being able to restrain themselves from eating marshmallows. So I think the field is now rethinking this and looking to see, you know, what is it that is actually driving things? And it may not be a willpower itself. People that seem to have good willpower actually set up habits where they are avoiding things, you know, like where they're not stocking their freezer with ice cream or they're not doing this or that. And they're, you know, so they're not caught in the midst of like an urge to eat ice cream. And then, you know, there's a ton of ice cream in the freezer. It's just not there. So what are people looking at instead? It's really looking at reward value more. You know, this is that oldest and the strongest part of the brain. And even if there is something, you know, consider willpower, there's this controversial notion of willpower and willpower depletion, you know, that people can resist ice cream in the morning, but it's harder to resist at night. If that is true, and it's still controversial, you know, that depletion piece suggests that this is, you know, this is the youngest and weakest part of our brain. So why not move into the territory that we know is really solid, you know, this reward-based learning system?
And in this reward-based learning system, you don't have to deploy your so-called willpower as much if there are other reward centers going on?
That's right. So this is, you know, this goes back to the, you know, that bigger, better offer piece. Our brain's going to naturally choose the behavior or the food or the whatever that feels better. And so it's a matter of helping our brains see the differential rewards more clearly. And there are treatments now, you know, for example, motivational interviewing that are designed specifically to help people discover that for themselves. So the, you know, the one-liner on motivational interviewing is, you know, if I have a patient coming into my office and they want to quit smoking, I say, okay, well, why don't you smoke more? And they look at me like, what? But the idea is to help them drum up from their own experience, like what it is about smoking that they don't actually like. And we can even take that one step farther where I have my patients pay attention as they smoke cigarettes. And we've done clinical studies around this where we've, you know, as people pay attention when they smoke, they realize that cigarettes actually smoke, you know, they taste like crap. And when they realize this, that reward value drops on its own without any willpower needed.
Oh, okay. And so when you're thinking about, you know, whatever it is that you're doing, whether it is smoking a cigarette or eating that meal, can you take us through a mindfulness exercise, the questions you should be forming in your mind and the sensations that you should be feeling inside your body?
Oh, I'd be happy to. So do you want, we could use an eating example. We could use smoking. What would be best?
How about smoking?
Okay, great. So.
Okay, great. You know, yeah.
Okay. Well, so for anybody out there that's really struggled with a cigarette, the first thing we have them do is we have them check to see what it is that is driving their urge to smoke. Okay. And so it's typically one of two things. There are physiological drivers, because nicotine has a half-life of about 2 hours. So every 2 hours, somebody's, you know, their nicotine levels get low. Their brain says, hey, I need my nicotine. And so they go out for a smoke. The other is psychological stressors where they, you know, might see an email from their boss. And before even opening the email, they're running outside going for a cigarette because, you know, they know it's not good or something like that, or the subject line, you know, says enough. So we have them just start to notice, okay, is it that I'm going into withdrawal or is it that I'm psychologically stressed? Then we have them just, you know, pull out the cigarette and, you know, light it up and notice what it tastes like as they take that drag into their mouth. You know, as they suck that smoke in, you know, how hot is it? What does it taste like? You know, what's it feel like going into their lungs? And then what's it feel like as they, you know, as they inhale it? What's it feel like as they exhale? And then also, what's it like afterwards? You know, like, what do their clothes smell like? You know, what does their breath smell like? All of this stuff. So they can really see all of the consequences of smoking. And I'll give an example. I had a patient who he'd been smoking for 40 years. So we calculated the number of times he had reinforced this habit loop. 293,000 times this guy had done this. And he looks at his cigarette. He's like, how did I not notice this before? When we had him do that mindful smoking exercise. Now, just to give you an example, in our first study, when we had people basically do this, we got 5 times the quit rates of gold standard treatment for smoking cessation in a randomized controlled trial. So paying attention can go a long way toward helping people quit smoking. Now, it's not just the paying attention as they smoke. We also give them mindfulness practices to help them ride out cravings so that they don't even need to go to the cigarette. But the primary piece is paying attention and having that reward value drop from the cigarette itself.
We're talking with Dr. Jed Brewer, author of The Craving Mind, From Cigarettes to Smartphones to Love, Why We Get Hooked and How We Can Break Bad Habits. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Dr. Brewer, going back to smoking for a moment and the psychological stresses, there are also the habits people form when they, maybe smoke with a coworker or go out to break at a certain time. What about breaking those habits?
Yes, that can be especially challenging. You know, on average, the patients that I see and the people that come into my studies, they start smoking when they're about 13 years old. And a lot of them, when they go to quit smoking, when they're down to the last couple of cigarettes, they literally say, I feel like I'm losing my best friend because this smoking has been with them through thick and thin. And so those pieces can be especially challenging. So what I do with them is help them just start to, you know, pay attention. Okay, loss is normal. You know, they're going through a grieving process of change. Change can be scary itself. You know, there are a lot of elements that they can pay attention to and notice, okay, this is normal. This might feel a little uncomfortable for a while, but it's kind of like, you know, growing up with a friend, you know, in high school, junior high or high school. And then realizing, you know, that friends, you know, we've kind of drifted apart. You know, that person is, I don't know, you know, they've gotten into things that I don't want to be associated with, or, you know, we've grown apart, and now's the time to form new friends. Well, the same is true with cigarettes. You know, they can realize, okay, this was something that has been with me for X number of years, and now it's time to break up. And the breaking up process can be challenging, but is always for the better. You know, I don't know anybody that's quit smoking and said, you know, doc, can you help me start smoking again? You know?
Yeah. With those psychological stresses, and you mentioned opening an email that you know is going to incur a lot of stress, how do you approach the actual psychological piece of it?
Well, this is where there are several things that we do here. One is, and my favorite, I think of this as a psychological superpower, is curiosity. So as we start to notice and become more familiar with the physical sensations, you know, like, for example, smoking, we can also become more familiar with the emotional responses that we have and the emotional drives that we have that drive us to eat or smoke or, you know, worry or whatever. And that awareness, we can actually bring in this element of curiosity and get really curious. So if there's an emotion that feels uncomfortable or feels really strong, if something feels unpleasant, our natural response is to make it go away, right? That's our natural reward-based learning system. But instead of making it go away, there's this saying, you know, the only way out is through. And so that means turning toward these challenging and difficult emotions instead of running away from them. The only way out is through. And as we turn toward them and get curious, okay, what is this emotion made up of? Where do I feel it most in my body? For example, with anxiety, we have people just ask the simple question, do I feel it more on my right side or my left side or the front or the back? And what that does is engenders this, you know, or brings up this curiosity. Where do I feel anxiety the most? And that itself actually feels pretty good. And as we get curious, that helps us start to see, oh, these sensations are just, you know, it's tightness, it's tension, it's heat, it's whatever, and that these come and go.
We have Brown University's Dr. Jed Brewer, who stays with us as we talk about the formation of habits and what we can do about managing the stress of the pandemic. Have you formed some good habits in these times? What have you changed about your life and how are you feeling now? What might cause you to stop eating more healthy or stop that exercise regimen? Are you concerned that leaving your home office and going back to an office building may bring bad habits and stress? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation now about bad habits and what to do about them with Dr. Jed Brewer at the Mindfulness Center at Brown University. Dr. Brewer, on that topic of curiosity, what happens when you shed your self-care? What happens if you say, I'm too exhausted to be curious. I am working in the COVID unit, and I can't think about myself right now. What about those feelings?
Yes, that's a really good point. Now, the nice thing about curiosity is it doesn't actually take much more than just kind of directing our awareness. And so, you know, if we're doing something, we can simply notice what we're doing and get curious about that. But if it feels like we're exhausted in that moment, if we can remember to, we can just ask, what's it like to feel like I'm exhausted? And that kind of creates that spark of curiosity itself, where curiosity is kind of self-sustaining and builds energy itself. Or my favorite is if somebody says, I can't be curious, then I say, well, just check out to see what it feels like not to feel curious. And that in itself kind of brings up that spark of curiosity.
We have Steve from Superior called in this morning, and Steve says there seems to be a high correlation among people who are addicted to both smoking and drinking. And Steve wonders, why is that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Steve. So a lot of people, you know, back in the day when bars were not smoke-free, a lot of people started to form associations between drinking and smoking. So they go to a bar, have a drink, have a cigarette. So there's not only that positive association, typically, you know, people are at a bar having a good time, but also that the alcohol can decrease kind of our cognitive control, you know, if there is such a thing. And so, mm-hmm. you know, if we go to a bar or we have a couple of drinks and we think, okay, I'm not going to smoke, it's actually we're disinhibited. So it's much harder to step out of old habits when we've had a few drinks. So those two pieces together can make it not only, you know, line those two up for life, basically. You know, it's like drinking coffee in the morning and having a cigarette. Same type of thing can happen, but it also makes it much harder to split that or to break those two apart.
Let's look at the situation with kids for a moment. Is there anything we should be watching for in children when it comes to habit forming and how young people form habits?
I think kids form, and I'm not a child psychiatrist, so I don't want to go out of my lane here, but generally speaking, children form habits in the same way that adults do. So same rules apply, so to speak. And they are also very, very influenced by adults, especially their parents. So if their parents, so I think this is important for parents to understand, if their parents can recognize habits that they might be kind of forming in their kids that they don't realize and might not be helpful for them later on, that's something that the parents can do. For example, you know, if you make it through the grocery store without screaming, I'll give you some candy type of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, that just teaches kids to scream for candy. So I'm just being, you know, using a generalization here. But if we can start to notice, you know, are we actually rewarding kids with food, for example, and this has been well documented, that's something that we can start to shift that over to just giving them unconditional degrees of warmth and love. That in itself is more rewarding than the candy itself. And so if we can learn to shift those types of things, that can help us not only have stronger relationships with our kids, but also help them not develop these habits in the first place. The last thing I'll mention is kids are amazing at being curious. So we can actually learn from them. And see, you know, the kids are outside like, oh, what's that? What's that? And instead of saying, come on, let's go, we got to go, like going with that. Oh, what is that? And kind of fostering and encouraging that curiosity.
Encouraging those questions and taking it further. How much do kids pick up with the modeling of behavior, bad and good, of adults and their parents?
Oh, I think especially from parents, and I don't know the exact numbers on this, but I would say a whole lot.
Yeah. We have psychiatrist Judd Brewer, Director of Research and Innovation at the Mindfulness Center at Brown University. We're spending the hour on habits, how to identify them and control them. Still time for your questions, 800-642-1234. Dr. Brewer, let's look at mentoring and peer mentoring in particular in recovery programs. How is it that when you have someone going through something with you, a buddy, for instance, someone to call, how much of an influence is that to being able to, you know, get your arms around that habit or that addiction?
I think it's really critical. So there are a couple of aspects here. One is just knowing that we're not the only one in the world suffering in this way can be really helpful and a burden reliever. The second piece is community. So often people turn to bad habits because there's a lack of connection or a lack of community, whether it's family or greater community, et cetera. And so developing or bringing in those community elements, whether it's just a peer, you know, like in AA, there's a sponsor and things like that. Sponsors are tremendously helpful. Having that community can go a long way toward filling that void that's often habitually filled, you know, with drugs, alcohol, smoking, eating, whatever.
Yeah. And having maybe that regular contact. And I would imagine, though, that all of that contact that was so helpful in in-person group meetings, for instance, that's all gone by the wayside in the pandemic and now must happen maybe on Zoom.
Largely it has. So I have patients who report that they're actually getting together in small 12-step programs, you know, 4 to 5 people at a time that they know, and, you know, they're kind of closed their circles in that sense where they, you know, they're able to do it that way. But I would say more often than that, most folks that I know of have gone online, and they report pros and cons. They'd rather be in a group than not. But, you know, the online element is not the same as the in-person element. The other benefit of online is you could be in a, you know, there, anybody has access to these online groups anywhere in the country, in the world. So there's more availability there.
What would you tell someone who feels like they just can't beat a bad habit or an addiction? They've tried and they've tried. What would you tell them this time around and amid a pandemic?
Yes. So I would say a couple of things. The first is you are not alone. Everybody is suffering in one way or another right now. The second is that there is hope. Like my lab has done tons of studies where, you know, we've got a 5 times the quit rates of gold standard treatment for smoking. We got a 40% reduction in craving related eating with an app. You know, we saw 60% reduction in anxiety. And so all of these are predicated on awareness, helping people understand their own minds. And so I would say, you know, just understand the simple aspects of these habit loops around your own mind and start to map those out. That will take you very far. Then pay attention as you do that behavior and see what you get from that. That will also help. The third thing I would say is, okay, now compare that to other things. So for example, you know, we just use the addiction example. You know, what's it like to drink alone versus actually be in community with other people, even if it's just virtual? You know, which one feels better?
Yeah. And so once you do all of those things, you feel like there can be breakthroughs here, even if you've tried and tried before.
Absolutely.
Where does this research go from here?
From here, I think, you know, I think the digital therapeutic world has just gone from adolescence to adulthood. It was forced to grow up very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So I think what we see, and I'm putting on my research hat, is, you know, more and more digital therapeutics that are developed based on mechanisms. So in the first wave, we've seen a lot of these things, you know, companies can stand up an app really quickly, but there's no evidence behind it. There are a lot of them that don't have any mechanism behind it. You know, it's just kind of like, here's an app, try it out. I think we're going to see this next wave of, you know, mechanistically based therapeutics where people are understanding what's going on in the brain and then developing treatments based on that and then doing clinical studies to show that those things actually work. And then we're going to see this whole revolution in the healthcare industry where, you know, these are cost effective. You can reach people anywhere in basically anywhere in the world. So people that have geographic isolation, things like that, can still get treatment.
Dr. Brewer, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jed Brewer is a psychiatrist, director of research and innovation at the Mindfulness Center at Brown University. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.